Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to the second Champions League takeaway of the week. Don't get used to this. They are going to be one a weekers when we get back to normal service in the Champions League. But we thought with 3 days of Champions League action this week, it would be remiss of us not to get a couple of episodes out talking about it all. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today here on Ranks FC. Joining me across the water all the way from San Diego, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, I'm good. It used to be considered embarrassing, didn't it, to be a footballer playing European football on a Thursday night. And there were some Arsenal players who have actually had that in the past. So when they're suddenly lining up on a Thursday night in Europe again, you're like, oh, what's happened here? But it's now Champions League night. What?
Thursday nights are Europa nights. We'll give them one off, but this is not happening again.
What are they doing on your turf, mate? What are they doing? This is ruining.
You know what? It works two ways, right? Because next week, Wednesday night, is Europa night, and that feels a bit weird in itself. But we get
they're
one back.
A crossover to attract new fans.
This is it, mate. This is what we're doing.
We need to do that on another podcast. So there's been a lot of football to take in this week. Hasn't been easy, actually, has it? Because they're back-to-back games in the days as well, and there's a lot to absorb. So I'm glad we've done this in two parts this week, actually. I don't know what happens across the rest of this tournament because there are just so many teams in the Champions League.
Well, there'll be nine games a night, so we're going to just have to do our best to get across four of them properly and
we'll
try and round up
the
rest, right?
Or that we think you'll be interested in, yeah, and then just like throw the scores onto the end of the others. But yeah, I think I might as well start. Seeing as I started talking about Arsenal there, mate, I think should I just take it on into?
Yeah, let's do tonight first, and then in part two we'll do Wednesday's action. So you could start us off. You could take us off with Arsenal. It feels like a bit weird to start with a 0-0 draw, but I still think it might have been the biggest result of the night.
Yeah, I mean, Arsenal would have been expecting to beat Atalanta. I think that's probably fair to say. Atalanta have built up some European pedigree in recent times, and I think that they're a respected side in this competition. But they are ninth in Serie A.
They have had a bad start,
and yeah, Arsenal would have probably expected to go to Bergamo and get the result. They've got a result. It's not the end of the world. They've come away with a 0-0. But let's face it, they've got their goalkeeper to thank for even being able to take a draw away from this match. It was an unbelievable double save from David Raya that has got Arsenal this point. Rotegi takes a penalty for Atalanta. David Raya guesses right, dives one way to his right and stops it. The rebound comes up and Rotegi's he's almost wheeling away to celebrate it. He's headed it back in the other direction to where Reyes initially saved his shot. And he's probably 99% convinced he's put Atalanta 1-0 up. But David Reyes, for the second time this season, raises from the dead to save the shot again. We saw his double save against Aston Villa earlier in the season. And now he's produced an even better one, right on the goal line, in the opposite direction to where he'd been going in the first place. I mean, on one hand, I was like, oh, is Rotegi the melon of the week here? But I don't think it's even that. I don't even think the rebound is that bad from him. I think it's just brilliant. I said last time that David Raya made a save like this, didn't I? That this is what you see the goalies practicing. The only goalie drill I could tell you is that they lay on the floor and they've got a goalkeeping coach throwing it one way and then the other.
I couldn't wait to ask you about this. I saw this penalty save and I was like, I know exactly what Dean's going to say.
He waited his whole life for these moments. Got two in one season.
Unbelievable.
Been doing it since he was 5 years old. But this is it, goalkeepers. This is why you do that exercise. Mm-hmm. One day you will get this David Raya moment. But yeah, you know, it comes at a key moment too, right at the start of the second half, and it would have put Arsenal on the ropes. So huge moment in the match. Definitely the most exciting part of the match. This was not a classic. It was a bit of a tactical affair. But full credit, which I don't often give to goalkeepers, obviously, famously. Full credit to David Raya, because this is a moment that we will remember for the rest of the season at the very least, mate.
Some credit to Raya, because pretty much a decade ago to the day, and I know he was 19, so you have to give it some credit, but he was playing for Southport in the Conference Premier.
Was he?
You know, in the start of the 2014 season, on loan from Blackburn Rovers. He was out of Southport a decade ago. And yes, he was a young goalkeeper, very young goalkeeper at 19. But, you know, a decade, and he's saving penalties, making unbelievable double saves in the Champions League. You know, it's one of those where your career path can take you to some funny places. But if you've got that talent, it allows you to get to the top eventually.
Fair play to him, mate. Yeah, he's been very dedicated. And obviously, when Arsenal signed him, there was a fair few people thinking, what's Ramsdale done wrong? Nothing, really. They've just signed a goalkeeper that's better. Simple as that. That's why Arsenal have got him. My other real takeaway from this game, mate, is, are Arsenal a little bit blunt? Like, it's a bit strange. They haven't had a bad start to the season. I'm not going to go as far to say that, but they're not scoring many goals. Maybe it's just me that's a little bit unimpressed with how they act and in the final third. But they're not scoring many goals. They obviously beat Tottenham at the weekend 1-0 from a set piece. Now they've gone to Atalanta and drawn 0-0. They go into the Etihad at the weekend. You go back before that, they had that 1-1 draw with Brighton. Okay, their first two games of the season, they managed 2-0 wins, but not wholly convincing. So, look, last season wasn't too dissimilar. I think we got to this stage and then they went and blasted PSV 4-0.
I was going to say, this feels very familiar territory, doesn't it?
It actually might just be how they settle into a season, and maybe it's all fine. But what obviously is different at the moment is that they've got Odegaard missing. Now, for this one, you had Havertz drop into the midfield and Gabby Jesus started up top. It didn't really work. Gabby Jesus was not on it. This was a big opportunity for him, particularly ahead of that game that they've got at the weekend, to put himself in the frame for a start there. And he was disappointing, to be perfectly honest. He didn't have a very good game. The ball didn't stick on him. He wasn't really physical enough. Never seemed like a true threat. He was substituted before the hour mark. Leandro Trossard came on, and then Kai Havertz moved to what is now a more familiar position of a centre forward.
Yeah.
And that might be what they have to do. It'll be interesting, because Havertz in place of Odegaard in the middle three isn't a bad idea at all. You know, like Havertz perfectly capable of joining the pieces together there. By the way, Havertz has still got in his locker from this season. He has played every single minute now of this season. Mm. Like, Kai Havertz becomes such an important figure to Mikel Arteta. So now he's got to figure out where he's getting these minutes as we move forward. And it might have to be that he gets them up front for now. I mean, Raheem Sterling got a few minutes here. He came on for Saka about 15, 20 minutes from the end. But you wouldn't say that Sterling's ready to probably start yet for Arsenal. It's plausible that he could play as a false nine at some point, but I doubt he's going to go and do that against his former club at the Etihad. So,
do you think this is hurting Arsenal? Or do you think this is hurting Kai Havertz? Because there has been this kind of conversation for a while, and we were talking about 8.5 star season, right? Players who have this kind of weird role of playing in midfield and also up front. And Julian Alvarez was someone who did something very similar for Manchester City. I feel like we've got to a point where what Kai Havertz does leading the line is no longer false ninety. Like, he's just kind of an out-and-out nine in many ways. What he does like doing is dropping and linking the play in this kind of Roberto Firmino-esque way. And that's why I don't like Jesus and Havertz together. I really like both of these players individually. And look, long-term listeners will know that I've been a Kai Havertz man since he broke through in that first season as a 17-year-old at Leverkusen. Mm-hmm. But I think that they occupy the same spaces when Havertz is moving forward from the midfield and Jesus is trying to drop deep and kind of pick up the ball in those areas. I feel like they tread on each other's toes a bit. And something that's been really interesting watching Arsenal when Havertz has been up front is that he hasn't actually done that. He hasn't dropped in quite as deep. He hasn't linked play quite as much when he's been playing in those areas. There's still interchanges, of course, but he doesn't feel like he's getting in the way of the midfield. And I feel like when him and Jesus play together, it often feels like they're getting in each other's way.
Yeah, I do think he needs to move back into the central position up front. Gabby Jesus hasn't done enough to prove that he can feel that anyway. Look, equally, like Martinelli out wide, I mean, a bit concerned about his output. I had a quick look just before we're about to record this. I don't think he's scored since March. He had half an opportunity here to score, didn't take it. I'm not sure about Martinelli even at the moment. So there's still room for growth, definitely in this season for Arsenal. But as a lot of teams will look at it in this first Champions League game in the new format, not losing is probably the most important thing. You've got enough time to find your rhythm as we get into the next seven matches that you've got to play in this format. So not the best night for Arsenal, but it could have been worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, any more on Arsenal-Atalanta? I thought that Atalanta looked a little bit blunt, generally, but equally should have felt like they'll do this. With the save, just one last question on this. Is it an unbelievable save? Yes. Should Rategi score anyway? Also, yes, I think. Just lift that header. There's no way that the keeper's getting across. He's scrambling along the floor. You put it into the top of the net, it goes in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to criticise. It's still, if I'd have headed that, I'd have felt it was in. And 9 times out of 10, I think it was in. He could have put it a bit further across.
99% maybe.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those. Like he will be in total disbelief right now as he leaves the dressing room and he has to go through the mix zone, and he'd be dreading people asking him about this because he won't have been able to process it yet. He won't have seen it as many times as we all have. All he's doing is replaying that moment in his head and thinking, how has he done that? How has he got there? And ultimately, he'll just have to accept that David Raya has done his job remarkably well.
Yeah, fair enough. One of those moments. It's not ideal for you if you're a new striker coming in to try and lay down your marker like Matteo Rategi is at Atalanta and missing an opportunity like that. But I'm sure he'll bounce back. He's a hell of a footballer and I'm a big fan of his. Let's go over to the Spanish clubs and let's start in the Principality, because the shock of the night came with Monaco dishing out Barcelona's first loss of the campaign. They beat them 2-1. And this was a funny old game, Dean, because Eric Garcia started in defensive midfield, which was a bit of a rogue move to begin with. But we've started to see with Barcelona that, you know, the depth is a little bit lacking. And this game hammered that home, that the depth is not there. And Garcia was sent off within about 10 minutes of this game kicking off. The ball was pinged out to him by Marc-André ter Stegen. That is a pass you play to Pedri. That is not a pass you play to Eric Garcia playing in central defensive midfield. And he miscontrols it and then brings down the attacker. It's definitely a red card. There's nothing you can do about it. He's a little bit unlucky in that he gets a bit tangled with him. But equally, it's just one of those pure moments of everyone's head in hands. And look, two things on this. One, Barcelona trying to chase this game late on really did feel like the depth options are lacking. And it's the first time I think we've seen from this Barcelona side that you're thinking, oh, there's a couple of players out. Obviously, Dani Olmo's picked up an injury now, and he was the big signing of the summer, the man who started the season so, so well. It just doesn't feel like Barcelona have the options off the bench to be able to change games. Now, that might change as players come back to fitness and, you know, Frankie de Jong to come back, Dani Olmo to come back, a few more to come back, Andres Christensen as well. But it just feels right now that underneath the first 11 here, you scratch a tad behind the surface and that depth isn't there. And I know that people have been talking about this and saying, well, look, Barcelona had an incredible start in La Liga, but are they going to be able to carry this out over the course of the season? This was a really tricky game. And this is twofold, because I'm worried about them depth-wise. But I will say this, they battled really, really well with 10 men for like 80 minutes of this game. They stuck at it. They created chances. They didn't look like they were overwhelmed. And yes, you kind of expect that from an elite tier side when they go down to 10 to not completely crumble. But considering the amount of youth that was on the pitch and considering how deep into the well Hansi Flick has already had to go in terms of La Masia, I was hugely impressed with the way that they applied themselves even after going down to 10. And so whilst they have lost this game away from home against a good side like Monaco, I don't think this is the end of the world from a Barcelona perspective. It might be the end of the top eight ambitions. They might have to think about going through the playoffs. But equally, I think you'd still see them sort of 9th to 12th when this all kind of shakes out. And yeah, I'm weirdly impressed with them for being able to play the way they did for, you know, the majority of this match, even if the second half felt a bit blunted.
Yeah, it's quite a surprise. Like, obviously, I've been watching a different game, so I haven't taken this one in. But when you look back at the results across all 3 days of the Champions League, this is the one that kind of smacks you in the face. Monaco 2, Barcelona 1. Obviously, once you see there's a red card involved, it makes a little bit more sense. But still, because Barcelona have been so hot, you think it's still a surprise. It's still a surprise. And it is a setback because they now find themselves with some work to do in this competition, knowing that they've certainly got tougher fixtures, let's say, in the Champions League. Fortunately, their next one is one of the easiest because they've got young boys. But then after that, you're by Munich and then you're like, well, you can't lose. You know, it's almost becomes, how many games can you lose in this format of the Champions League?
Two, exactly. If you want to finish in the top eight.
There you go. So that one's going to be a key one. Obviously, later on in the tournament, one of their fixtures is Borussia Dortmund away. So they've got some tough games coming up. They'll probably be fine. And you do put it down to the fact they've had 10 men for so long. But it definitely sticks out.
It's an interesting one because I know this is about the Champions League, but Barcelona have Villarreal at the weekend, who are another of the unbeaten sides in La Liga so far. And Villarreal have started the season really, really impressively. They've just been very controlled. They don't have European football. They've had a week off. Barcelona have now played on a Thursday night for 10 men for 80 minutes with the squad as thin as we know we are. I wonder what the knock-on effects are for this, for the Villarreal game. So something just to keep an eye on the weekend, because there's a lot of players here who looked out on their feet by the end of things, as you'd expect, right? From running around for that long with a man down. But it's still quite interesting watching it and seeing how it plays out over the course of it. Just a couple more on this. Magnus Agliouche, who it was a France under 21 international in the summer, played at the Olympics, didn't really have a particularly good game when they played against Spain in the final. But he was unbelievable in the first half here. The way he takes on his man, the way he glides past defenders, he scores a wonderful goal. He drops his shoulder, fires it in near post. Absolutely nothing that Ter Stegen can do about it. But just one of those players who's kind of been on the edge of the radar for a little while. I think anyone who's been kind of following under 21 football will have noticed him come in. He's a couple of years in from his debut now. I think he came in as a 16, 17 year old when he made his debut for Monaco and has sort of drifted in and out of the side. He's up to about, I don't know, 45, 50 caps by this point, but hasn't really established himself as a starter before this season. And then suddenly you come into this and you're like, ooh, okay, that's interesting. Suddenly he feels like he has exploded. Back end of last season, he really felt like he lifted off. But watching him tonight against a very, very impressive Barcelona team full of really talented youngsters, he felt right at home in that company. And that's, you know, high praise considering where he was. But you just go back to him time and time again. Lamine Yamal, like, he scores the equalizer here. And it's completely out of nothing. He just drifts off, fires a shot in from distance, catches the keeper completely off guard. And first Champions League goal. I believe he's now the youngest goal scorer for Barcelona in the Champions League. It's just remarkable, Dean. Every single time you think he's done something else. And his decision-making, time after time after time after time, is correct. And his football IQ for a player of this age is just absolutely ludicrous. And I think I don't think he's saying anything particularly out of the ordinary or out of character to say that we're witnessing something special at this point. But he just continues to defy like any sort of sense of how old he is. Like you could be looking at a 24, 25-year-old with the decision-making that he has, with the football intelligence that he has, with the ability to read the game that he has. And we're talking about this at 17. We were talking about this at 16 when he was still 16. Like, the sky is the limit. The world is his oyster. We've got hope that his injury record remains solid, but so far so good, touch wood. But I mean, just remarkable. And look, it was a crown jewel in an absolute star-studded cast today of young players, including Akliushe. But a lot of players on this pitch, very, very young and showing exactly what they're capable of in, you know, on a big, big stage, right? So Georgia Linkana played, Elias Ben Seguir played. We saw this very young Barcelona team that included Pau Cabarsi and Marc Casado and Yamal, Alex Balde. You saw the players coming off the bench and you're like, Flo Balogun, a little bit older, obviously, but still Ansu Fati came on, which was nice to see. Pablo Torre had such a good year at Girona last year. Gerard Martin, Sergi Dominguez. It was really nice to see so many youngsters on a big stage. And I thought that the game deserved, you know, the praise that that is, because these two teams have been very, very good. Some by need, some by design of bringing through youngsters, and they deserve their flowers for that, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking this about Lamina at the weekend when he scored two goals against Girona. And actually, Dylan asked me the other day for a Lamine Yamal Barcelona kit. I was like, you've just literally last week got an Mbappe Real Madrid kit. I don't know if it's okay. Can you have both when you're 6 years old? Do you think that that's all right?
Probably.
It probably is. And like, it's obviously a bit more, it's player worship rather than club worship, isn't it? Like, this is the thing. Like, Dylan's already caught onto the fact that Lamine Yamal is special. And I do quite like the kit of Barca right now. But I just think
your away kit's really nice. The one they wore tonight, really, really lovely. I really enjoyed it. Black with the sort of red and blue, almost like
nice
shiny on it. It was very cool. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but yeah, Lamina, mate, never stops. He's going to get better and better and better until it's impossible. And then everyone's calling him the new Messi.
Yes, I mean, perhaps that is inevitable, but we'll try and avoid it as long as we can. Quickly over to Madrid, because Atleti won 2-1 against Leipzig at the death. Couple of thoughts on this. One, Antoine Griezmann is still so unbelievably good at football. It is an absolute travesty that he was having a think about leaving Atletico this summer. And he is still, when he ticks, Atleti tick. And there are so many moments in this game. I mean, I don't know.
I actually do think he's underrated. I don't think I rate him enough. I genuinely don't.
I think I made a case last year for Griezmann to win the Ballon d'Or. So I feel like I
mean, globally, not by you.
I feel like maybe not from this department at the very least. But yeah, I mean, I still think that most people see Antoine Griezmann as a great. I think that him leaving Atleti and going to Barcelona in that entire episode probably tarnished his name a little bit. But just watching him at this age, and again, we talk about decision-making, you talk about that just sense of football IQ, knowledge around it. Everything he does is just right. And he puts an absolutely glorious assist into the box for the first goal here. And you're kind of looking at it and thinking, this man's very, very special. And then he goes again, right? And his creativity creates the second. And you're like, wow, this man has just put on an absolute masterclass. And in a summer where Atleti have signed Sorloth, they've signed Conor Gallagher, who Simeone, we've heard, sees as kind of an advanced 8/10 option. They've signed Julian Alvarez on top of all of that. You're like, oh, are they trying to phase Griezmann out? There was links to him obviously going to LA, going to MLS. Were they trying to move him away? No. There is no way that if Atleti are successful this year, Griezmann is going to be at the heart of it again.
I don't know, mate. I think he's going to LAFC next year. I really do.
He might do, but it would be a point where he is still so far and away the most important player in this Atleti team that I think they will have huge withdrawals when Antoine Griezmann leaves, because he's the lightning rod through which everything good goes through this Atleti team. And on a night where Rodrigo de Paul was whistled off because of another relatively poor performance in the middle, it's interesting watching Griezmann as opposed to that and seeing, you know, how they function without him. It's, mate, he's just remarkable. And like, I know I feel like I'm really kind of hero worshipping at this point, but just watching him play football is an absolute joy.
Yeah, no, I know. That's how you feel when I used to go five-a-side. So I understand when you start to feel like this.
How you felt when I was at five-a-side.
Yeah, I was past the stage where I couldn't run anymore, so I was just envious. But yeah, you're allowed to, mate. You're allowed to worship players like this, especially when they keep going when they're assumed to be finished, because he ain't.
Yeah, he definitely isn't. Look, Leipzig gave a really good account of themselves in this one. They were unlucky to lose. Their Jose Maria Jimenez header at the death kills it. 2 points. Leipzig are a heap of fun going forward, but they're still pretty lapsy defensively at the moment. They need to sort that quickly if they are going to be in the title race in the Bundesliga. And I don't really see any reason why Leipzig shouldn't be, but they just still feel a wee bit too open, a little bit too basketball-y in terms of being able to control games. But on that goal, what a lovely moment for Jose Maria Jimenez, because he's what? Lost two Champions League finals with Atleti. He's been the guy at the back for so long. For him to pop up with the winner late on in this one felt like a real moment. And you could see it, how much it meant to him. He was like on the pitch, staring at the fans, like tears rolling down his face, kissing the badge. And I was like, that is such a nice moment. You to do that at the Wonder, first time in the new Champions League, for you to be the guy. It was so beautiful. So I just wanted to give him his flowers because that was real nice.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Fair enough.
Do you want to take us on to Leverkusen?
Well, I will, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. I'm going to keep it pretty brief, I think. Feyenoord nil, Bayer Leverkusen 4. And it was Florian Wirtz day, basically. He'd been waiting for this moment for his whole life, Jack. A Champions League debut for Florian Wirtz. Sounds silly, doesn't it? This is a player that should have been like Lamine Yamal and playing in it since he was 16, 17. He's only 21, but he's finally played in the Champions League and he's finally got a goal in the Champions League. In fact, he's got two. It went very, very well for him. Now, the reason this is dragged on, why he hasn't made his Champions League debut yet, is because when he's had the opportunities, he's been injured. So he hasn't been there when the opportunities have been about for playing in the Champions League previously. But they've waited, they've been patient, he's stayed with them, and here he is. And they arrive in the Champions League as German champions. They go to Feyenoord with 3,000 travelling fans, and everybody leaves very, very happy because Wirtz turns it on. He was delighted afterwards. He was given player of the match, and he was like, you could just tell he was absolutely buzzing. He said, I couldn't have imagined that things would go that well. I've been really happy over the last few days imagining that I would finally be playing in the Champions League. I'm pleased I played like that and that we played well as a team. Yeah, I mean, they just blew him out the water, mate. The game was dead by half time, 4-0 at half time. And Feyenoord, just no way back from that. That's the one thing we know about Bayer Leverkusen. When they put their foot to the floor, there's no stopping them. So it was perfect. Xabi Alonso too, obviously, goes into this competition as a coach and looking to build even further his reputation and pedigree as a top-level coach. I said he shouldn't have stayed at Bayer Leverkusen. I thought he should have taken the Liverpool job, but he wanted this opportunity. This is why he stayed, right? To take this team the next level. He got them here. He wants to see it through. And so it was important that it all started well. So a good night for Wirtz, a good night for Xabi Alonso, and a very good night for Bayer Leverkusen. 4-0.
Yeah, away from home. Great start for them. Shout out Jeremy Frimpong too as well. 2 assists for him. Really nice. Yeah. But Leverkusen stars look like they're starting to click again this season. And that's pretty scary for everyone else, I think, because as we know, when they play like this, there are a few sides that can stand up to them. And that's how good they can be on a night like this. One to watch.
8 goals in their last 2 games now. They're back.
Yeah, 100%. And also, more than that, they haven't conceded a bucket load at the same time, which has been the kind of thing that haunted the start of the season. So who knows? Maybe Leverkusen are right back where they were. We'll keep an eye on it. Just to round off today, Red Star Schwenzvesta lost 2-1 at home to Benfica. First time they've lost at home since Man City went there last year, which is a pretty incredible record, to be perfectly honest with you. Benfica started this really, really well. They obviously changed managers last in the international break. They won their first game back against Santa Clara 4-1. And then they came here and they blasted out of the blocks. And it's a really good goal, the second one from Orkan Kökçü, a beautiful free kick. But it was the two Turkey boys who scored for them, up to Koglu as well, got the first one. And then Kökçü, who's had a bit of a rough ride of it at Benfica, getting the second. Nice moment for him. Big season for him, because with João Neves leaving, there is a gap in that midfield and someone needs to fill it. And that's what he was expected to do. Well, he was expected to come in and step into that gap when Enzo Fernandez left. he kind of got usurped by this unbelievable Seychelles Academy kid. But he's gone now too. So Kökçü has that opportunity again to kind of stamp his authority. And it's important to remember how young he is still. He was captaining Feyenoord at 21 years old. So for him to be now in this Benfica side and what should be kind of coming into the prime of his career, this is big. And Bruno Lage seems to like him. So that's a good thing for Kökçü. And I think if they get him going, good thing for Benfica too. Angel Di Maria, by the way, ageless, completely ageless. Another one just absolutely ran the first half here, playing like ridiculous diagonal balls. He was just joy throughout this first game. So I was like, oh, that's nice to see, especially given that he retired from international football in the summer and they weren't sure if he was going to stay at Benfica or where he was going to go. He still looks like he very much belongs at this level. So a nice one for Angel Di Maria to remind us of his quality. Benfica did nearly throw this away. So they concede in like the 87th minute and the pressure had been slowly building. The Maracanã had been getting louder and louder and louder. And it's an intimidating place at the best of times. But Benfica had done a really good job of shutting up the Spanish Resta fans in the first half. But they got louder and louder and louder and then they scored and the place went absolutely apocalyptic. And you're kind of like, oh God, are they going to collapse? And they were a little bit lucky to hang on towards the end, to be honest. They very nearly threw this away. So that fragility that existed under Roger Schmidt still remains, and it's going to take some time to get that out of the system, but a really good result to go there and get this done. So shouts out to Benfica because they could have thrown this away and they didn't. Mm-hmm. So they're off the mark. Awesome. At a very difficult place to go. And the other result of the night was Brest on their Champions League debut, winning 2-1 at Sturm Graz, winning 2-1 against Sturm Graz. I was going to say at home, but it wasn't. And it's a really sad one. They're not allowed to play in their own stadium, Brest, because it doesn't meet UEFA requirements. Seems a bit harsh when young boys are playing on an artificial surface. Yeah. The Brest aren't allowed to play in their home stadium, but they played a really good game here. And to be honest, this should have been 5 or 6. They had a lot of opportunities, especially late on. Sturm Graz had a player sent off towards the end of things, but Brest should have put the game to bed by then. But look, for them to come to the Champions League first time, the Pirates from Brittany, and win their first game 2-1, really good. So shout out to Brest as well.
Lovely stuff, mate. Lovely stuff.
There you go. There's your roundup of the end of things. After the break, we're going to be talking about all of Wednesday's action, including that game between Manchester City and Inter. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, where we're going to take a look at Wednesday's action. And Dean, you watched the absolute thriller, the corker, the goal mouth scramble that was Manchester City 0-0. What did you make of it?
Well, look, it's nobody's lost, so that's good. That's good. Everybody can be satisfied with not losing the game. Inter Milan probably feel like they maybe deserved the win a little bit more. But I don't know. Man City had opportunities. The main takeaway, mate, is that Inter Milan are just so, so good, right? They're sexy. This is a sexy team that knows what they're doing. I haven't seen many teams that are able to play like this against Manchester City. And they do it all the time. But it's just more obvious when they're able to do it at this scale. Like, the fluidity of their build-up play is just incredible. Like, the way that the players move positions so naturally and the connectivity between all of them, it's like it's all synchronized. And obviously it is to some extent because they do it in training. But that doesn't mean it should look and should be carried out this flawlessly. So I'm just always kind of impressed by Inter Milan and the fact that they are so coordinated in their play. So there's that, right? Inter Milan were extremely good. What they were also good at was creating a barrier to entry for Erling Haaland. And by kind of caging him, by blocking off the access to him, and then matching him physically with Acerbi, and ensuring really that he was surrounded and backed up at all times. It was so frustrating for Haaland. And he hates that. This is what he hates most about football, I think. This happened every week. He'd give up at the end of the season because he would just be like, I'm not playing anymore. This is ridiculous. You're not letting me score goals.
It's my ball.
It's my ball. It's my game.
It's my match ball. give it to me.
But he wasn't able to do any bully tactics here. Acerbi stood up to him, more than stood up to him, mate. He almost bullied him, I think. And it was a masterclass, really, in defensive play from Inter Milan that locked up Haaland. And obviously Man City should have more to their game than that. The problem is, even when they did show it, Sommer and goal did really, really well. So that made things even more difficult for Manchester City to find their breakthrough. So all across the pitch, Inter Milan were absolutely brilliant. And that's how good you have to be, obviously, to stop Man City from winning at the Etihad. Now,
and even then, they had these two chances with Gundogan at the end.
Saying that, it is worth noting that Man City could and probably should have actually won the game. So yes, Inter Milan, I think, were the better team. Inter Milan were probably the better constructed team. Player by player, they won all their battles. Man City had two good chances at the end, three in total, to actually win this game. Even Haaland, although he was shackled, he still came very, very close to scoring a goal in one of the few half chances that he actually had on goal. And obviously, Ilkay Gundogan has these two late opportunities. Phil Foden was really lively. Probably, possibly, Man City's best player once he was involved. But generally, there were just too many little bits for Man City that were off colour. And I'm not just talking about their kits, which was absolutely dreadful.
Yeah, they were bad.
I don't even want to talk about that. Disgusting. But, you know, like Rico Lewis has had a good season. Didn't play that well at the weekend. Couldn't really get connected here either. Gundogan and Grealish, perhaps a yard off it at times. KDB couldn't pull the strings and goes off injured. The extra yard of progress that City really needed to make, they were just behind on it. So ultimately, I think for Man City to come away from this with a 0-0 is totally fine. You've got seven games left to play. You've learned an early lesson in the Champions League and you've managed to come through it and you can go home and analyse it and figure out how it can make you better. I think that's probably the best way they can go back and view this game.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. One, I love how much Inter love defending. I love how much these three centre-backs...
It's Italian, isn't it? It's very old-school Italian.
Yeah, but like there is an element of these three in particular, I think, in this game, Bastoni, Acerbi and Jan Bissek. They love defending their own box. They're like, it's like their lives depend on it. But I thought that Inzaghi played this really well. And look, I said this on Sirius on the breakfast show, if you haven't heard. I'm on Sirius XM on the radio now and in America. So if you're over there, tune in. I'm often on the breakfast show with Tom Rennie, Thursdays a lot of the time. But I thought what he did here was really smart. So Carlos Augusto played instead of DeMarco. Matteo Darmian played at right wing back instead of Denzel Dumfries. Zielinski played instead of Mkhitaryan in the midfield three. Now, Zielinski is a relatively attacking footballer, but he has more of a kind of defensive work rate, I think, and he has already been asked to do more of a defensive work rate than he ever had at Napoli in this side. So not only do they have these three absolutely unbelievable centre-backs, they have Jan Sommer. And I saw some of the comments today, right, talking about Jan Sommer. They're like, wow, Jan Sommer, the game of his life. I was like, did he? Did Jan Sommer let in 19 goals last season and also win the European Golden Glove? Like, Jan Sommer is an unbelievable goalkeeper. And he's been doing this since he joined Inter. To be honest, he's been doing this for most of his career. Mönchengladbach, he did very well for Bayern when he came in. And now he's started doing it with Inter Milan. So the defensive element of it pushed back and it allowed them to crowd out Haaland and also the creators in the middle. Zielinski's work rate alongside Calhanoglu, who's become the second best six in the world, and Nicolò Barella, who is just magnificent all of the time. It was brilliant in there. And then they made the massive call. Lautaro on the bench. Mehdi Taremi up front, allowed Thuram to basically play as the striker over the top, and they could try and play off Taremi's physicality. We know for a fact he's got that Champions League pedigree. We've seen it with Porto. So I thought Inzaghi set them up perfectly. And then you kind of come to this conclusion. And what I was thinking was, with Klopp now not in the picture, over the last 3 years of managers that are still with their clubs, Inzaghi has to be a top three manager in Europe, right? And his Inter side, you behind Real Madrid and Manchester City, perhaps, Inter are the third team in that conversation, right? They're the ones who have been constantly excellent. And so much of that is down to Inzaghi's tactical ability. And he showed it again here, I thought.
Yeah, he's a bit of a master, isn't he? Oh, he's a total master, in fact. I mean, I talk about all those things about structure and coordination and connectivity, and it's all because of him. It's his brainchild. He's put it all together. You get a group of players like this, and of course, like, there are always expectations. And even if you were to just let them go and do what they want, they would probably still win half their games across the season. But you've got to win or come close to winning every game in a season. And that's why you need a mastermind boss. And Inzaghi is proving to truly be one of the best bosses in the world right now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, talking of best bosses in the world, let's go over to PSG, who won 1-0 against Girona. Lucho's side got off to the winning start they wanted. My first thought, Dean, and I'm sure that everyone's seen this back by this point, is poor old Paolo Gazzaniga. So Paolo Gazzaniga's resurgence has been absolutely remarkable, because 3 years ago, that man was playing as Fulham's backup goalkeeper in the Championship. Mm-hmm. And then he went off to Girona, and he was part of this incredible story that took La Liga by storm last season, that ended up being, you know, an absolute force in La Liga. And he now plays in the Champions League with Girona. So, I mean, shouts out to Gazzaniga, because that is some comeback. He then drops an absolute masterclass in this game, right? He makes four or five absolutely sensational saves. He does everything right until the 90th minute, where Nuno Mendes' sort of cross shot squirms through his legs and into the goal. And you can see the kind of life drain out of him, right? You can see his soul leave his body. It's one of those moments where if this hadn't happened, we would have spent this next 5 minutes talking about what an incredible defensive display it was from Girona, and also how good Paolo Gazzaniga had been at organising that defence and then coming up big when he needs to be. And instead, the entire narrative is about him making this mistake. So, first of all, I feel real sorry for him, and I still think he should get his flowers for an incredible performance. But equally, that is the way that the game goes. And they say keeper's the loneliest position, because you only need to make one mistake and everyone is only talking about said mistake. And I suppose that cliche is no more true ever than it is right now here. The other thing is that for all of that, I thought PSG were really good. And especially in the second half, once Asensio had gone off, unfortunately with an injury, but they brought on Kolo Muani, they created loads. And there's a moment where Ousmane Dembele does the most Ousmane Dembele thing of all time. He runs through on goal. He's got a man to his left. All he needs to do is either shoot or square it. And instead he dithers, and he allows Ladislav Krejci to make one of the best defensive tackles you'll ever see, from behind, on a booking, in the box, cuts his foot round and pulls it away. And it's a brilliant, brilliant challenge. He should never be given the opportunity to make that challenge. The ball should be in the back of the net 5 seconds earlier, but it's not. And that's where Ousmane Dembele is frustrating, right? That final pass. But actually, I thought he was really good. I thought Barkley was really good. I thought the midfield worked really nicely. PSG created loads in the second half, just couldn't quite find that finishing touch. They needed that bit of luck. Ultimately, I feel for Girona, but the better team very much won here.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I saw that you had to choose a dark horse for the Champions League, and PSG were your pick.
I'm super hot on Lucho, right? Everyone knows this. Luis Enrique is my guy. I absolutely adore the man. I think he's brilliant. And
They're a dark horse, isn't it? But yeah, they are.
Well, I mean, I think the question was phrased as kind of anyone that isn't Real Madrid and Manchester City, who are most people's two favourites to win it. And I said, well, my next one would be Inter, but if you don't want me to talk about them, then PSG, are really good at this point. So this was the thing. I think there's been a lot of conversations about who's in that bracket, right? Barcelona have been thrown around that bracket. Bayern have been thrown around. Arsenal, Liverpool. I think all of that is fair. But I didn't see many people talking about PSG, and I think that people are probably not paying attention to how good they've been in Ligue 1 to start the season. And Julien Laurent said a really interesting thing on TNT Sport. He was saying that maybe the 11 is more important than the one in terms of Mbappe. And yes, there are going to be games where they miss that killer instinct, 100%, obviously. But over the course of a season, is having a team and a structure that works in your favour more important than having a superstar who can occasionally put the ball in the back of the net? Maybe it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So disappointing for Girona. They're down to 26th now in the Champions League.
At what point? So just on that, at what point does the league table start to make any like sense or no? Like what time did you start paying attention to the league table? Because obviously right now the league table is absolute nonsense. Like Celtic are second and in. Much as that delights me to the absolute rafters, like there is no chance of Celtic finishing in the top eight of the Champions League.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. If you say to an AC Milan fan, oh, how's your team getting on this season? Oh, we're 10th in Serie A and we're 29th in the Champions League. Not great then. It's quite funny though. It is hilarious, like how you start to reflect on this. Like if your team bombs in the Champions League and you come, yeah, like 33rd. Like if you're one of the better teams that considered to be, and you come down there, you're getting the sack. Because it's embarrassing to be 33rd in a league or 35th or 36th even. But it's also highly amusing right now. Shall I take it on, Jack?
Yeah, let's go to Borussia Dortmund, shall we?
Yeah, they're fifth, actually, in the Champions League.
They shouldn't be. I'll give you that for free.
Yeah, well,
The
reason they are is Jamie Gittins, formerly known as Jamie Bino Gittins, came on for a 17-minute cameo and won in the game. Now, look, the boss, Nuri Sahin, he doesn't really know his best team at Dortmund yet, I don't think, at this stage. Not sure he even knows what formation he should be playing. I mean, for the first three games of the season, it was all a bit Nagelsmann. It's like 3-4-3, and then he changed formation when you haven't got the ball. But now we're starting to see Dortmund move back towards a 4-2-3-1. Happened at the weekend, and we saw it again here. He's not taking many risks with his lineup, let's put it that way. And as a result of that, Jamie Gittins was on the bench, and there was no signs of a breakthrough until he came on. Okay, he scores his first goal and it's a deflection that loops into the far corner.
Correction, there were signs of a breakthrough. They were just from Club Bruges.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm going to talk about them in a minute, so that's why I haven't mentioned that. For Dortmund, there was no signs of a breakthrough. Then he produces this moment that does open the scoring. And then he comes up with the second goal. It's a wonderful moment. He's like, I was going to say twinkle toes, but it's not even twinkle toes. It's like body swerves or something. I don't know. Like
three stepovers in 1 second is very early Cristiano Ronaldo vibes. I'm not saying that they're the same player, but like in terms of style, that very quick three stepovers and the extra one where he really doesn't need to do it, he can just shift the ball, is very early Cristiano.
And he always has. And whenever I've watched him at Dortmund or even before that coming through in England, you're like, he's just doing a bit too much. He's overcomplicating this. Where just get to the end product. Stop doing all the stepovers. Stop doing the tricks. Don't go and beat him again.
Bloody works here though, didn't it?
But this time it was absolute. It was beautiful. Brutal, overwhelmed, and the ball ends up in the back of the net, and it's 2-0. Game done. But as you say, the other takeaway is that Bruges had chances, probably should have won it. Skov Olsen is such a danger. I think he's a great player. But it wasn't quite to be his night. They played so well, right? And they really do take risks on the ball. They're very brave in possession. And at times, to beat the press, they would play some extremely risky balls out the back to even go straight through the middle of the park. They're a very, very watchable team. But their fans will be really disappointed because they paid the price for their mischances. And they come away from this, you know, they've lost it 2-0. They're 31st in the Champions League. And you're looking back on it, you're like, oh, yeah, that's where your casual football viewer would have had this game going. You'd have said, oh, Dortmund, away win, 2 or 3-0. And it really wasn't that. Like, you've got a team here coming up against the Champions League finalists from last year. Or Club Bruges, was it Conference League, wasn't it? So, it's, you know, technically in European terms, they should be miles apart. And they really weren't. But it is the Champions League finalists that got the job done. Maybe that pedigree did count in the end, but ultimately it was just Gittins made the difference.
I really like the kind of age profile of this Club Brugge team. I know that sounds like a bit weird.
It's lovely.
But like Vetlesen and Scott Volson are 24. They're just coming into their prime. Christos Solis, who was at Norwich for a little while, is 22, I think, and really was effective, I thought, on that left wing. Hans Vaneken gives them a little bit of kind of experience in there and a little bit more of, a deeper dive into, where he is. He's, what, 31, 32 now? Then there's Rafa Onyedika, who is excellent and I really like. I mean, his big opportunity last year, he ended up getting sent off for one of the big games he had. But Joel Ordonez is a youngster. Mekel is an older player. De Kuyper is about 24. Saez, who played right back, who ended up, a little bit scorched, but, played really well. He's 19. They've got a really good mix, I think, in this Club Brugge side. And often when you look at these teams, there's a lot of young players coming through, a lot of like developers. It feels like they're right in the right bracket to compete. And I think we saw that. They felt like they were unlucky, right? Vetlesen should score from the one he hooks against the crossbar. They felt like they were just a little bit, two or three inches either side of winning 2-0 against Dortmund. I think they're going to be an annoying club for teams to come up against here. I'm not saying they're going to end up I don't think it's out of the question for Club Brugge to end up in the playoff spots, above 24th, but like whoever comes up against them, you're in a game, I think, at this point. And for a lot of people who would have looked at this fixture list and whatever and looked at Dortmund away at Club Brugge to begin with, I think people would have just gone like they'll win. And obviously they have. But I think that people will probably look at this as an easy game. And I don't think they're going to give anyone an easy game.
No, I absolutely don't either. I was really impressed with them, actually. As I say, they're very watchable. I think I do mean that as a compliment. I'm not trying to be condescending or anything. Like, I would recommend that you try to grab one of their games.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's come on to the other three games. I'm going to start with the team who, Dean, are second in the Champions League right now. I haven't seen these kind of heights since 67 and the Lisbon Lions. Celtic 5, Slovan Bratislava 1. Now, there was a lot of chat about this, and obviously Slovan Bratislava are first-timers in the Champions League. They're Slovakian champions, and I think a lot of people had them ranked as one of the weakest sides in the competition. And to be honest, on yesterday's showing, I think those people are absolutely right. It's like that meme. It's like, the haters said I couldn't do it. Fair play to the haters. They were absolutely right. But you kind of look at this performance from Celtic, and I don't know if you've seen any of the scenes from Celtic Park beforehand, but it was absolutely raucous. The roar that kind of greets the end of the Champions League anthem, the rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone. It was absolutely spine tingling at Paradise yesterday. And Celtic responded. They should have been 3-0 up before they scored. Liam Scales eventually opened the scoring, but a couple of major chances, one to Kyogo, who's the guy you want them to fall to, right? One to Nicholas Kuhn as well. You're kind of waiting for that moment to drop. And actually, once Celtic got going, they looked really, really good. Arne Engels signed for a club record fee in the summer, 11 million from Augsburg. Well, you can see why, because this kid ran the midfield. He was absolutely sensational. And when you're kind of looking at what comes next for Celtic, Borussia Dortmund away, and they will look at that from yesterday's game. They will look at what happened in that fixture. They will look at what Dortmund did against Club Brugge, look at the opportunities there, and they'll look at the way that they were able to put Slovan Bratislava, admittedly a far weaker team, to the sword. Okay. And they'll think, why not? Because this midfield of Engels, McGregor and Hatate really feels like it has an excellent balance to it. Yes, Celtic are still a little bit scrappy at the back, and there were opportunities. The goal that Slovan Bratislava scored, Kevin Vimmer, ex-Tottenham, scores a glorious goal with Travella with the outside of his foot from left back. I'm not sure how that ended up going in. And because it was a 5-1 loss, no one's talking about it. But Dijsselmeijer scores, Kyogo scores, Kuhn was excellent on the right flank in terms of creating things, Engels scores the penalty, and then off the bench, you get Ida coming on and scoring as well with a lovely assist from James Forrest, and Liam Scales gets the other one from a corner. Celtic looked more balanced than I've seen them in ages, and there was obviously the Ange Postecoglou era where Celtic kind of were able to dominate a lot of the domestic stuff, but couldn't really bring that style onto the big stage. where it feels like Brendan Rodgers has them in a way that they can translate that. They're going to still be able to dig in deep when they need to. The midfield is really industrious now. It's not as creative as it was with Matt O'Riley in there, but my God, they work hard. And this front three will run themselves into the turf. And then off the bench, there is like not, you're not talking about world beaters here, but there's quality of a similar level, right? Adamida coming on and replacing Kyogo, pushing for a start. You're looking at a player who comes on and made a beautiful finish from Adamida to score that goal. There's a lot of depth now, I think, in this Celtic side in terms of the drop-off doesn't feel way too much when a certain player gets injured. There are still obviously key players, but it doesn't feel like they're going to completely and utterly lose the plot if Matt O'Riley goes out. And last year, I think it did feel like that. So yeah, having replaced him and found that balance, Celtic felt in a really, really good place. And yes, all of these things, pinch of salt, Slovan Bratislav, I get it. But just on kind of general viewing and having seen them, you know, play in the league as well and being perfect so far in the Scottish Premier League, this was a really impressive translation considering that domestic form has not translated to the European stage for Celtic over the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a pretty mad result to see coming through. But, you know, Celtic, they've been due one, Jack. They've been due a big Champions League night.
Yeah, indeed. It was lovely. I played football early last night and then I watched this in the pub. I took the advantage of the one night that I wasn't actually, you know, recording straight afterwards to watch it with a lot of the lads I play football with, and it was absolutely brilliant. The pub absolutely going off. I've not seen that for a long, long time. So yeah, very, very nice. Just to wrap up yesterday's action before we finish, Bologna 0, Shakhtar Donetsk 0. A couple of things. The atmosphere at the Dallara was amazing. It was really wet, rainy, but what that meant was it ended up being really smoky because obviously Bologna fans brought loads of flares anyway. Yeah. And therefore they didn't really light properly. So the whole game was covered in that kind of mist, which you kind of associate with old European games and I absolutely love. Bologna got away with it a little bit in the first half. Shakhtar missed a penalty. Great save from Skorupski, actually. But they grew into this and probably feel like they should have won it. It was a little bit of a shame that Dallara didn't get to see that. And I think that in a couple of weeks, when they look back at this, they will look back at Shakhtar at home and think that's a game we should have won if we really wanted to push for a decent position in the Champions League. But you know, just being back in the competition after 60 years, having this game and just the atmosphere there being incredible was really nice to see. Shouts out to Shakhtar as well. I was really confused as to why they weren't wearing orange. I was like, that's not a kit clash. What's going on?
Yeah.
But they wore blue and yellow stripes, the colours of the Ukrainian flag, to continue to raise awareness of the plight of what's going on in Ukraine. So nice touch. I didn't really notice this. And on a night where City's kit took the headlines for being absolutely horrendous, I thought it was nice to put a nice kit or a good kit on the agenda as well. So shouts out to Shakhtar.
Well,
and then Sparta Prague beat Salzburg 3-0, which was a bit of a shock result, probably one of the shock results, I think, of the round so far. And interesting, Salzburg just feel really young. Now, I know this is what they do. And obviously Pep Lijnders is in charge and we've seen Bobby Clark go there and by Cetic and a couple of other Liverpool youngsters. But it does feel like this Salzburg side is just very, very inexperienced. And what happened was they went to Sparta Prague, who are quite sort of battle-hardened, not necessarily in the Champions League. This is their first Champions League win in 19 years, but in European competition over the last couple of years, we've seen Sparta knocking around in Europa and the Conference Leagues and doing pretty well, right? Not setting any worlds on fire, but getting through to the knockout stages relatively regularly. And it just felt like that experience completely told, because this Salzburg side on paper is a lot more talented than the Sparta hosts, but they just didn't feel like they had the nous to know what to do with it. And obviously Salzburg end up on the conveyor belt quite a lot, right? A lot of players leave every summer. They either go off to Leipzig or they kind of translate around Europe. The production line's incredible, but it just feels like they're right at the start of a new cycle and they quite haven't settled in yet. And I thought it was interesting watching them and feeling just how young and inexperienced this side was yesterday.
Yeah, Salzburg will be obviously really disappointed with that. And they're one of those teams that you do look out for because they produce young talent, but they also produce shock results along the way. And that would have been a matchup where you thought they'd have a chance for a result. So 3-0 is pretty resounding.
Yeah, very much felt that way. And also it didn't feel like that was it wasn't like a Dortmund 3-0 where, you know, yeah, they'd been battered for 70 minutes and then gone on and won. This was very much the right result, I thought, out of the back of a victor. Olatunji took them apart. Really, really good performance from him, actually, and one to keep an eye on, perhaps. But yeah, that takes us through the rest of it. Any more thoughts, Dean? Any more thoughts on the league table?
Blimey, I'm absolutely exhausted, mate. We can only reflect on the league table by congratulating Bayern Munich for ending week one at the top, thanks to their goal difference of 7. So that resounding victory, which we spoke about previously, 9-2 over Dinamo Zagreb, has paid off. They are top of the pile. And Harry Kane, maybe he will win something, mate. Maybe he will.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, it's going to be interesting how goal difference is going to play a part. I don't think anyone's really quite taken that into account yet. Like, group stages, yes, okay, occasionally goal difference came into play, but not very often. But actually, this could be quite, like, there could be 5 or 6 teams on the same points very, very, like, reasonably after 8 games. And I think it's going to be intriguing to see how teams approach that towards the end, or in the games where they, you know, have a significant advantage, like Bayern's opener. Are they going to go for broke in this? Are we going to see some big scorelines racked up? Because that could matter at the end of it.
Absolutely, yeah. We'll see. Well, none of us know what to expect from this, do we? So a lot of people predicting that the latter games end up in a lot of dead rubbers and boring matches. But it might not go that way. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I'm not convinced is probably how I would put it at this point. So I think we might see some big, big scorelines in those late games. But for now, I think that's pretty much it from us, Dean. So all the stuff for me to do, say thank you very much to you from all the way in San Diego.
Oh, mate, it's only 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but I think I'm going to go to bed. See you later.
I'd love to go to bed, but there's more work to be done, sadly. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC with your second Champions League takeaway of the week. Thank you so much for listening. Very soon, very shortly after this goes up on the feed on Friday morning, there is going to be a new episode of The Truth, where Doogie and Sam are talking about Pep Guardiola and the idea that he might have ruined football. We dissect that and the arguments for and against on The Truth. So make sure you get stuck into that one tomorrow. But for now, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you very shortly, gang. Take it easy. Peace.